So for our first speaker this morning is Paulina Garland from the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT. Her work spans computer vision and machine learning and statistical analysis methods for the characterization of biological processes from images. So today she'll be talking about non-parametric atlas-based segmentation of highly variable anatomy.
Is this on? Oh, perfect. Good morning, everybody. Before I tell you about this piece of work, let me preface this with saying that my group works on modeling shape variability or anatomical variability across populations, as well as its connection to function and understanding how anatomy relates to function. We do this in brain imaging as well as other images. So today, I will specifically focus on the problem of anatomical variability. So this will be quite related to what Xavier talked about yesterday, except for we will look at a different application. And specifically, we will look at an application of segmentation in images. This is a it's a long-standing problem in biomedical image analysis as well as computer vision, which is for biomedical image analysis, usually we get a three-dimensional image, say MRI or CT of a patient, and the question is, where is a particular organ of interest? Experts can do it quite well most of the time by going slice by slice and using their knowledge of the anatomy to actually find the structure of interest. And we, of course, are interested in automating this process so that we can apply it in mass to large number of images. So to preview the results that I will be showing you at the end of the talk, our work leads to quite robust and accurate segmentations. I will show examples of brain segmentation where we find quite detailed, accurate parcellations of the brain. So this is sort of a coronal slice like this, and this is an axial slice that goes like that. Even in subjects with pathology such as neural degeneration, as well as segmentation of the heart. So these three examples are examples of heart's left atrium that are so variable in shape and the number of veins that attach to them and locations where the veins attach that you can't really model them as spherical, let's put it that way. Simple shape models don't quite work for these shapes, but what I'll show you today actually does, and we achieve quite accurate segmentation. Okay, before I can show you how we do it, let me set up the problem a little bit. So over the years, it's been sort of accepted in biomedical image analysis that you can't do this problem by just looking at this individual image intensity, because the intensity is ambiguous about which structure you are in. And in fact, by observing experts, we sort of know that they use all of their knowledge of anatomy and the previous knowledge about what the organs look like to do the segmentation. So traditionally, computational methods have mimicked that approach. And specifically, given a whole collection of images and the manual segmentations by the experts, we will treat it as a training data. And specifically, what we will do is estimate a parametric model of the variability in that collection. We will, this atlas construction step typically co-registers all the images into a common coordinate frame and then averages a particular label in that common coordinate frame. So for example, here, this shows what you get by averaging those binary labels for white matter in the brain, right? So you get this fuzzy picture where this corresponds to, I'm almost 100% confident it's white matter, whereas as I go to periphery, it sort of gets a little bit blurry because even in that common coordinate frame, there is variability across subjects. Now, given a new subject, we will register that subject into the template of the atlas and transfer these average maps to the coordinate system of the subject. So these average maps serve as a parametric prior. And the reason why I think of it as parametric is because we are capturing very simple statistics of the population. So in some sense, we are modeling it with the Bernoulli distribution at every voxel. And so then by taking a look at the intensity itself plus the prior, we come up with the segmentation of the white matter for this particular subject. Recently, so this has been quite successful. The problems in which it fails is if there is lots of fine detail. Because if there is lots of fine detail or great variability across subjects about where these details are, this averaging completely kills all of those details. Because it's enough to have just slight misalignments to get gray mush in the prior that actually is not quite informative about the new subject. So recently, this new approach to segmenting images using priors has emerged. It's much more algorithmic rather than probabilistic. And in fact, what it does is it keeps the entire training data around. So in that sense, you can think of it as a non-parametric modeling, right? I'll represent my distribution or my variability by actually keeping the examples. Given a new image, I will register all of these images to here. So this step is quite expensive. I'll move all of the binary labels through this registration into the coordinate system of this subject. And so now I'll get the subject-specific prior without going through the atlas, like in the previous case. And it's been shown to be more robust and more precise in some of the applications in biological images. So what I'll show you in this talk, so this approach is quite algorithmic, basically. I gave you a recipe, but it doesn't model the distribution of the images. So what I'll show you in this talk is a probabilistic model that leads to an algorithm of this sort. And as usual, once you create a general probabilistic model, it actually implies a variety of algorithms depending on what assumptions you make on the distributions. And some of them actually even are more accurate than what I just described. But all of them have in their nature this non-parametric representation where the variability of subjects across subjects in the test in the training data is not assumed to come from either Bernoulli or Gaussian distribution, but instead we keep the entire collection to represent the variability. Okay, so let's charge ahead now. And of course, I'll show you examples of results of this. So here's my general setup for the generative model. I'm going to take registration completely out of this model. So I'm assuming that all of the training images are already registered to the test subject. So in some sense, it's actually a significant flaw in this model, and I'll come back to it at the end of the talk. But for now, let's actually imagine that everything already got aligned, and we have methods in the field to do that. So once it's aligned, here's how I can think about this particular style of segmentation. I have a collection of images. Each one of them comes with the label map where it says which structure it is in every pixel or a voxel. To generate a new image, so this is a generative model, I create this field or image. So this variable M is hidden and it's the size of my image. Okay? And in every voxel, it tells me from which training image that voxel got sampled. Okay, so it's an image of indices into the training set. So right now it sounds like a crazy invention, but I will make sense of it. For now, just accept it the way it is. So this M tells me from where to go in the training image to get the intensity and the label. And so it governs generation of both variables, both the image intensity and the label at the same voxel. And so this image we get to observe. And our goal is to find the best segmentation that goes with this image. And the way we will do it now that we formulated a probabilistic model is through maximum a posteriori estimation. In fact, you can think of these as providing prior on M, and our goal is to find the maximum a posteriori estimation of L, which is the label, given the observed image. Everybody who's done probability a little bit will know that it's equivalent to maximizing the joint probability of the label and intensity, because I can represent the posterior probability as a ratio, and one of them is a joint and the other doesn't depend on L. So this is the goal for today, right? Maximize this probability distribution. And again, if you've ever done sort of Bayesian inference, you will immediately say, oh, this is really hard. And the reason why is because this distribution has to sum over all of the possible configurations of M in order to actually formulate it. So of course, we're not going to be able to write it for any arbitrary case, but I'll show you how we solve it either by approximating or by using some assumptions about these distributions. Okay, so let's get more comfortable with this M, because that's really at the core of this construction. So you can make different assumptions on M, but effectively, always you can think of it as a field of indices into the training set. So if I assume that every voxel is generated completely independently from all of its neighbors, then I end up with a field that might look like that if I sample from that distribution, right? Every voxel has a different, different value. I can, for example, impose some prior that gives me patches. Of course, these patches wouldn't make sense in anatomy modeling. In anatomy, you would want the patches to be sort of somewhat adherent to anatomy, for example. We're not going to go that complicated. What we'll do is we'll consider a Markov random field prior on these patches, where effectively, if the M, so this membership, at a particular voxel agrees with its neighbor, that's good. Right, so beta tells me by how much it's better to agree than to not, right? Over and with some over all neighbors. So for those of you who have seen Markov random fields before, it's sort of a little bit a trivial, sort of very trivial model. For those who haven't, think of it as I am going to enumerate all possible configurations, and I will like configurations where voxels agree with their neighbors about where they came from. If I set beta to zero, then this term effectively goes away and all configurations are equally likely, and effectively you can think of every voxel generated IID from a Bernoulli distribution. We're back to this pixelated example. As I crank beta up to infinity, so if I go through intermediate betas, if I start sampling M's, they will look more and more smoother and smoother because voxels will want to agree with their neighbors more and more. And as beta approaches infinity, actually, it's going to force all of the voxels to be the same membership. So effectively, we're saying I'm going to pick an image, a whole image from the training set, from the test set, and make it a new training set. So clearly, there will be some good medium to work in. All right, so once we've done it, as I alluded before, we have this prior on M, and we have to sum over all of the possible configurations. And with a little bit of algebra, you can show that the conditional probability distribution of labeling images, so this is an assumption of the algorithm here, that once I told you from which image pair of images to sample, the labels get generated independently of intensity. Effectively, this captures noise in labels, which could be like, for example, Bernoulli kind of noise, and this captures noise in image intensities, which could be something like Gaussian. And so in reality, this is what we do. So this is one instantiation of this model, and it's not clear to me that sort of it's hugely important how you instantiate this model. So what we do is very simple. Given an image in the training set, the new intensity is just Gaussian with some variance and we'll estimate the variance. For this noise, so this is the probability that my label here is equal to some number that is an index of a label, given what I've seen in the training images, we will use this trick of distance transforms to kind of be a little bit more gentle than 0, 1, right? So if this is my binary segmentation, I will create a distance transform image, and my probability will be proportionate to the exponent of that. So effectively, if I'm inside a particular structure, it will tend to 1 as I go more and more inside for that label and to 0 for all the other labels, whereas if I'm on the boundary, this allows me to sort of slope it a little bit and say that I don't believe the training image is 100%, but there is nothing sort of super deep about this. You can think of this as an analog of Gaussian priors. Okay, and so we've specified all of the components of the model, so now the question is how do we actually fit this to the images? So first, let's look at the simple case of beta equals to zero. So if beta is equal to zero, and I have the model here so that you can sort of remind yourself once in a while. This term is the same for all configurations of images. This is great because we effectively can remove that sum, right? It's just a constant. And suddenly, my probability distribution becomes a product over all voxels of this likelihood and that likelihood. Great, because now I can make decisions separately at every voxel because my probability distribution is fully factored over the voxels. And so the decision rule that comes out of it, if you actually maximize it, is quite simple. So at every voxel, I will look at sum over all training images and sum this product. And the label that gives me the highest value wins. So to understand this a little bit, and it'll be more useful for the general case, we can look at this product as this term provides a vote, meaning that this term tells me which label I should be, this particular training image votes for, right? And so it's a smooth vote, it's a fuzzy vote, it's not 0-1, it's a little bit sort of relaxed. And this term provides a weight for that vote. So let's understand this term. It's a Gaussian distribution. So the closer this term, this value is to that value, the closer I am to the peak of the Gaussian. So effectively, training images with intensity that is similar to my observed intensity will have higher weight to their votes. That's what it means. So we call this weighted voting scheme or weighted fusion scheme, as opposed to majority voting, which you get with different assumptions on intensity and the labels. So if I actually make these binary, 0-1, and if I make this uniform for all intensities, then I end up exactly with majority vote, right? I go over my entire training set, I tally up how many ones I got for a particular label, and I pick the majority one. So the majority vote is actually what I told you about at the beginning. What we get out of this is sort of a relaxed version of it with weights. Okay, so let's go to the more complicated example. Now we have a prior on our M that actually smooths it over. For anybody who's ever worked with MRFs knows this is bad news, right? Because now suddenly we have to actually sum over all of these configurations and there is no way around it. So that's intractable by our current knowledge. So instead what we're going to do, so here I'm going to give you two slides where if you don't know anything about EM and variational EM, just space out and I'll tell you when to sort of focus back in. If you are familiar with that and want to see sort of the details under the hood, we're effectively doing either variational EM or variational Bayes that are different names for the same thing, which is specifically we will approximate the posterior distribution by product distribution. And we'll look for the product distribution that minimizes scale divergence between that and my true posterior for current guess of the segmentation. And then, so this just says that we use mean field for the product distribution. And then in the M step, we will find the segmentation that takes that approximate posterior distribution as weight and similar term for the label as before for the vote. So for those of you who zoned out, now is the time to cash it back in. So effectively, this is an iterative algorithm. In one half of the iteration, I approximate the weights given my current segmentation. In the second half of that iteration, I update my segmentation based on the approximated weights, right? And the algorithm bounces between both of them. So if you're a probabilist, think of it as variational EM. If you're an energy cost kind of person, think of it as optimizing energy using coordinate descent in the parameterization of probability distributions and segmentations. Now, I put these terms here to remind you how this relates to the previous expression for beta equals to zero. Effectively, instead of actually true likelihood of observed image given the training set, now I have this posterior probability distribution that my voxel came from that training image. So this takes into account intensities, but also if we go back, If we go back, the way it's updated is it looks at the neighbors. This is where the Markov random field comes in. Rather than just looking at the voxel itself, it also looks at what the neighbors did in the previous iteration. And then the vote, it turns out that the update actually operates on votes, on log probabilities as votes in this case, as opposed to the probabilities themselves. Okay, so this replaces the vote before for the simple case. And so again, it's an iterative algorithm that will just alternate between the weights and segmentation estimation. And for those of you who really like this kind of stuff, if you tend beta to infinity, right, everything becomes coupled, and there is only one label per image that you need to estimate. So again, the problem becomes easy. Not as easy as beta equals to zero. So it becomes easy in the sense that we can compute E step of the EM algorithm in a closed form. So instead of using mean field approximation, we actually run exact EM. So that's sort of the detail. Okay, so now let's look at the results. I have two types of results. One of them is we ran it on brain images. This is sort of almost a benchmark of an application right now in biomedical images. If you don't have segmentation of brains, it's sort of like you haven't even started yet. It seems to be like one of these applications that you have to show the results on. So we have 40 to 39 images, these anatomical scans. So I will use two baselines. And again, for those of you who are outside of the field, don't worry about it too much. So this is basically a package that gives sort of, it's acknowledged to be the state-of-the-art parametric atlas that summarizes my prior knowledge as summary statistics. Okay, and so that will be our benchmark for a parametric atlas. And majority voting, I already told you what that is. That counts all of the votes. It basically makes votes hard, 0 or 1, and it sets all the weights to 1. So that and does that. So in some sense, it doesn't look locally at how similar your intensity is to the training images, right? The training images participate only through labels after you've done registration. All right, and so this is sort of obligatory slide. We have beautiful segmentations. Furthermore, this is the parametric atlas, free surfer. This is majority voting. This is the two variants of our method. They somewhat outperform the two methods that I showed you as a benchmark. I'm not particularly proud of these results. This is more like a sanity check that we actually can do brain segmentation, right? We outperformed them by 2%. Oh, I should say, the y-axis is a volume overlap measure. It's a DICE score that somehow my field is in love with. So what it does is it takes volume of the overlap and divides by average volume of the two label maps, the one created by an expert and the one that the algorithm produced. So it's some measure of overlap, volume overlap, where 1 means perfect overlap and 0 means no overlap, right? So you want to be high on this. And so the classic, the sort of state of the art is 86%, 88%. As I said, that's not something to write a paper about. And again, we have more detailed results where we did it for a whole variety of structures, and the message is that we win not by being extremely good on one structure and then averaging with lots of garbage. We actually consistently slightly better than other methods, but again, this is more of a sanity check. What I want to show you that actually gets people excited is the cardiac application. So I already showed you the examples of 3 left atria. So these come from 3 different subjects. These are normal, healthy volunteers, and there's tremendous amount of variability in shape. If I asked any of sort of my colleagues, including myself, who have done shape modeling, I wouldn't know how to model a shape like that. It's open, it's not closed shape, there is a different number of veins, they attach at different points, and the shape itself is very different, right? So this has been sort of typically an example of this kind of thing is very hard to do with explicit parametric models of shape. So we have 16 subjects, so we will be doing leave-on-out cross-validation as opposed to testing on new data because we basically are limited in the data. And so let me get you a preview why this application is exciting. So for computer scientists, it's cool to get good numbers in terms of accuracy, but clinically, this is an extremely important application. Because right now, lots and lots of people undergo what's called cardiac ablation, or in this case, it's atrial ablation. So if somebody has arrhythmia, they have irregular beating of, so particularly atrial arrhythmia or atrial fibrillation, they have irregular beating of the left atrium. And this happens because, well, this is our current hypothesis, is that it happens because of the abnormal electrical currents that effectively short circuit and create beating, sort of, they set off the muscles in the wrong phase of the cycle. That's what sort of arrhythmia is. And the current, there are several alternative competing treatments. One of the common ones is actually to do ablation, which stands for killing the tissue. It's sort of a polite term for that. So you can either burn or freeze little patch on the surface of the heart, and if you guess the location of the patch right, then that actually breaks the short circuit because scar tissue doesn't conduct. And so for many people, that's a solution, right? You burn just a little bit of tissue and the circuit is restored, and even though the heart is not as strong now as a muscle because you just destroyed some part of the muscle, because the electrical control now works, it's actually a much better situation. Unfortunately, it's only successful in about 70% of the cases. 30% of people come back for the second procedure. So there are lots of theories about why that is, and lots of them have to do with the scar shape and how you ablate, where you put the burn marks. And There are lots of theories, but there is very little experimental data. And the reason why is because, not because we don't have images, but because to do this, you would actually have to get that information out of the images. And there are statistics on a very large data set of these images, right? So the only way to do that effectively is to do automatic segmentation and analysis of the images. Okay, so with that long-winded preview, these are sort of the type of results we're going for. This is manual segmentation of the scar on the surface of the atrium. Everything is done manually here by an expert. This is the kind of automatic segmentation we will get out of our method. So first, let's look at the left atrium segmentation itself. So in this application, it's crucial to get the veins right. It's not just important to get your volume overlap. It's important where you lost those voxels, right? And that's why I'm showing you pictures. So these are the examples of sort of where classical methods fail. So this is manual segmentation in three different subjects. I just chose a particular slice where it illustrates the problems. So this is an expert segmentation in pink. The parametric atlas is sort of the state of the art segmentation technique that averages the prior information. The majority voting is that flat voting, and the weighted fusion is our method. So a bunch of things to see. First of all, these methods sometimes miss veins. Like, this is just basic, this is not okay, done. Like, nobody would accept this, because if you can't actually identify the veins, you can't then correlate the scar with the location of the vein, for example, which seems to be an important issue. In addition, the classical method basically is driven a lot by intensity. So it does this sort of thing in the space, in the place of an aorta. And so you can say, well, what's the big deal? Let's do filtering, post-processing kind of and all that. The problem is it does it so much that it's very hard to actually see the true segmentation from all of the details that it produces that are false positive. So I'm showing you three examples, but we've looked at every case in our study, and basically every one of them is done correctly using our method. And in addition, we have the numbers, but it's not clear to me, again, that the numbers tell the whole story, but the numbers say that we're better than the other methods. And so these are the kind of segmentations that we get. So how do we get the segmentation? You take an image and you segment the left atrium, which we can do, and that serves as a spatial prior for where the scar is. The scar shows up as bright dots. The problem is there are a gazillion other things that show up as bright dots. What this allows us to do is to only show you the bright dots or enhanced dots on the surface of the atrium as opposed to everywhere else. So now suddenly somebody can actually look at this or analyze it across many subjects. So I've shown you sort of two pieces of evidence that this is a robust method, and now we have a probabilistic model for it. So the question is, what do we do with it now? As I said at the beginning of the talk, one of the big problems right now, as far as I'm concerned from the theory point of view, is that we assume that the registrations, the best registrations, meaning the transformation from every training set to the test set, is God-given. And we're going to trust them, and they're not part of our probability model. But in reality, this is not true, right? The whole field of image registration actually works on finding the best registration. But it's well acknowledged that if I want to align images of two different subjects, there isn't a ground truth registration, because it's not a biological process you're trying to estimate. It really is a mathematical, it's sort of a figment of our mathematical imagination. And so in reality, what you would have to add to this model is, in addition to the hidden membership, there should be also hidden registration. But now you're talking about marginalizing over fields, right? So it's either really scary or really exciting, depending on which side of this auditorium you come from. So that's what we are working on. There is another issue with the registration, which is it's very expensive. I swept it under the rug right now, but effectively, your intuition should be that the more subjects you have in your training data set, the better you should do, right? Because you're learning more and more and more about your images. But the more subjects you have in your training set, you pay linear penalty in registration cost, in the sense of running time, right? So now some of these segmentations take 24 hours, which is clearly unacceptable for any kind of reasonable application. And so we always say, oh, but if you run it on a 1,000-node machine, you can always get it down to whatever you want. But I find that unsatisfying, specifically because in non-parametric modeling field, we know that at some point, you don't get better by getting more samples. If you want certain accuracy, there is a number of samples for which you start saturating. And empirically, we see that. And yet the algorithm sits there and registers, right? And it's very satisfied with that, except for almost all images provide exactly the same information. So we're working on models that actually will figure out how to get away from that and, again, construct summaries that are sort of somewhere in between simple summary statistics and full images so that we can make the algorithm efficient. And, again, this is not just sort of an empirical programming kind of exercise. You can build probabilistic models that lead to that kind of algorithm. And in the clinical application, applying this to 500 subjects is sort of what we're doing in the very near future. Okay, so before I conclude, let me thank my collaborators again for providing lots of insight, cool ideas, and sort of clinical understanding of what we're doing, as well as very generous sources of funding. So to conclude, what I've shown you today is, to our best knowledge, first probabilistic model for this label fusion that explains why majority voting works as well as it does and suggests other variants that actually work even better, that take more detailed local information into account. Now, this provides a framework for actually putting more local information in. You can craft that prior for the membership differently. So if you think that the regions should sort of respect anatomical boundaries, maybe a prior that actually encodes that would lead to even better results. That's just one idea. We've shown improved segmentation in two domains. In brain segmentation, which is a very mature application, we show that we do quite well compared to the baselines. And in cardiac, as far as I know, we have no competition for creating fully automatic segmentations in these hard images. And so my main excitement about this work is that it starts getting into models of anatomical variability that diverge from the standard sort of unimodal Gaussian models, right? It is forcing us to think about models of anatomical variability that allow multiple modes, that allow the kind of variability that we actually see in the images. And so I'll be excited to talk to people offline about that because we have some initial work on that area too. But my hope is that, again, it will come back to still improve the image segmentation problem, which is clearly sort of a bottleneck in many, many clinical applications. Thank you.
So thank you very much. So we have time.